From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the uprising in Los Angeles. We'll talk to Janet Clayton, an assistant editor of the Los Angeles Times editorial page. After a day of considering how the paper will respond to the violence, she'll be going into the curfew zone where her mother lives. We'll also hear from Mark Whitlock. He's heading a security force organized by the First AME Church in South LA. He spent last night standing between police and protesters in order to head off violence. Later, we'll talk about political advertisements with Neil Oxman. He designed the TV ads that helped Lynn Yackel win the Pennsylvania Democratic primary race for the U.S. Senate. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Sporadic violence continues in Los Angeles today, with the city struggling to handle fires and incidents of looting. The rioting follows yesterday's acquittal of four Los Angeles police officers. Steve Prophet has the latest from Los Angeles.
Any hope that things in the city might calm down today have now been lost. Looters are ravaging stores in a wide area of the city, and much of South Central Los Angeles can only be described as chaotic and out of control. What's most alarming is that the violence, looting, and arson seem to be spreading. There's now a major fire just south of the downtown business center, and a number of other blazes have been set around the University of Southern California. Tonight's basketball playoff game between the LA Clippers and the Utah Jazz has been canceled, along with a variety of other events. Officials here say they'll try to enforce a sunset-to-sunrise curfew, which they hope will help them try to restore order. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Prophet. In Los Angeles.
The Congressional Black Caucus met with Attorney General William Barr this morning and requested that the Justice Department take action against the four Los Angeles policemen acquitted yesterday in the beating of Rodney King. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
The Congressional Black Caucus warned the Justice Department not to delay its assessment on whether it would file federal civil rights charges against the officers involved in the Rodney King case. California Representative Maxine Waters said that the rioting in her L.A. congressional district could spread to other cities unless the Bush administration acts quickly.
We're not asking for an assessment. We're asking them to prosecute. We believe that they're guilty. Most of America believe that these officers are guilty. Los Angeles is under siege.
Waters was also joined by other caucus members, as well as white and Hispanic congressional leaders, in appealing for public calm after yesterday's court verdict. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
The House has voted to overturn the Bush administration's rule that forbids staffers at family planning clinics from giving women information about abortion. President Bush has threatened to veto the measure, and today's vote fell short of the two-thirds majority needed to overrule a veto. The vote was 268 to 150. The administration recently issued new guidelines that would permit doctors at publicly funded clinics to discuss abortion with their patients if there were medical reasons for doing so. The guideline still prevents other clinic staffers, including nurses, from discussing abortion. Opponents of the gag rule say it infringes on freedom of speech. Supporters say that federal funds shouldn't be used to advocate abortion. Stock prices closed sharply higher today on Wall Street, encouraged by reports of a gain in factory orders and a rise in the government's index of leading indicators. The Dow Jones Industrials gained nearly 26 points to close at 3,359. This is NPR News. Reports from Bosnia say that masked commandos blew up the last two bridges linking the republic with neighboring Croatia, cutting off the escape of thousands of people fleeing the ethnic war. At least 10 people were reportedly killed when the bridges were bombed. Commanders of the Serbian-controlled Federal Army refused to withdraw their forces from Bosnia today. About 100,000 of the federal troops are helping ethnic Serbs who want to carve an independent territory of their own from the multi-ethnic republic. Bosnia's majority Muslims and their Croatian allies voted last month to declare the republic independent. In Czechoslovakia, two newspapers today published the names of almost 300 journalists who had allegedly been informers for the old communist secret police. Burton Bolag reports from Prague.
The list was prepared by Czechoslovakia's new security service and leaked to two right-wing newspapers. Both printed the list on a full page with the name, birthdate, and secret police code name of each alleged journalist informer. The publication has rekindled the debate here over calls for the publication of the names of all of the 140,000 Czechoslovaks thought to have been enticed or coerced into spying on their friends and neighbors. The government has so far refused on the grounds that that would be unfair and vindictive. Some of the accused journalists today protested their innocence. One of them charged that the publication was part of a campaign against left-of-center journalists. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Bolag in Prague.
Chrysler Corporation today reported a $13 million loss for the first quarter. The nation's third-largest automaker was the last of the big three to report earnings for the first 3 months of the year. GM and Ford reported profits, but Chrysler still hasn't been showing signs of a turnaround. Chrysler acknowledged that its losses would have been substantially greater if it weren't for some one-time gains from accounting changes and the sale of a stake in Japan's Mitsubishi company. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Los Angeles is still erupting after yesterday's not guilty verdicts for four Los Angeles police officers accused of beating Rodney King. An angry uprising has resulted in violence, arson, and looting. At least 9 people have been killed. Community and political leaders have been trying to channel the rage. There have been demonstrations and some violence in other cities. We called Janet Clayton, the assistant editor of the Los Angeles Times editorial page. We caught up with her earlier today in between editorial meetings and wanted to know what the editors would be saying about the situation in tomorrow's paper.
It's obvious that there will be an appeal for calm, but beyond that, there has to be some context to this reaction. And as we were talking about this morning, the uprising that is occurring in Los Angeles is not just about the Rodney King verdict. It is about an earlier verdict in which a 15-year-old black teenager was shot in the back of the head, and the woman who did it was sentenced to community service and a small fine and probation. It's a culmination of events that have occurred, I think, not just in this city, but in this nation. In the last 10 years or so. And people feel powerless. And in this town, you've got a dwindling percentage of the black population. And it's ironic because you have a black mayor for a long time here, Mayor Tom Bradley. And people might assume from that people feel empowered. But black people in this town do not feel empowered. They feel under siege. On a personal level, on professional levels. And this frustration is palpable, and it's very frightening, because even in a church last night called First AME Church, which is one of the large, very politically active churches in Los Angeles, a lot of the talk last night there was broadcast. And what was interesting was that these were people who were church-going people who believe in turning the other cheek, who were middle-class people, well-educated people. But when some of the politicians went to the podium and appealed for, in effect, you know, be calm and be patient and vote for things on the ballot in June that will make things better, a lot of those middle-class Christian people said, no, we're tired of waiting, we're tired of being patient. And their anger was just inflamed by some of the comments of some of the jurors who basically said that, well, Rodney King was in control of this situation. He brought it on himself. In effect, he asked for it. And that's just more than people could take. The saddest thing, of course, is that this anger has manifested itself in violence, which is only destructive to the very black community that so desperately needs to feel empowered, and in effect, it's economic suicide, which is occurring in the black community in Los Angeles. And I think people need to look at this, because I think they're fooling themselves if they think that these conditions exist only in Los Angeles.
I'm wondering, you know, I've heard so much about how African Americans are stopped because they're black in Los Angeles by the police. And I'm wondering if that's happened to you or to friends of yours, if you have any firsthand understanding of that.
I have never been stopped. This typically happens to black males, but I should tell you, I don't know any black male in Los Angeles, and I'm talking about from people who are unemployed to lawyers and doctors, who have not in the last 10, 15 years been harassed by police officers at some point with remarks like, what are you doing in this neighborhood? Why did you stop me, officer? Well, you look like the type that might be into trouble. What is the type? What is the problem? What are you talking about? Get out of the car, spread eagle, that sort of thing. That is very common, and as I said, I actually grew up in Los Angeles, so I have a long point of history on this, and I don't know any black male under the age of 40 who at some point has not had that occur to him.
I don't know how old you are, but were you around during the Watts riots?
Yes, I grew up here, and I was a kid during the Watts riots, and I remember it certainly. I remember seeing the images and so on, and I did live in what was then considered the curfew area. I did not live in Watts. They made the curfew area very broad, as they have this time. In 1965, the curfew area went for about, I think it may have been 10 or 15 square miles. The actual rioting and looting and burning only occurred in a fairly contained area of a couple of miles or so. This time, it's also a very broad area that they have put under curfew. And this time, I must say that the arson and the fire damage seems to be much more widespread than it was in Watts. It's all over. It's all over the south part of the city.
Are there any comparisons that seem appropriate to you?
To Watts of 65?
Yeah.
Well, the one big connection, of course, is that it involves frustrated black people and the Los Angeles police. I mean, that's the most obvious comparison. But what was also interesting was that last night, when the violence started downtown Los Angeles in Civic Center, where the police headquarters is, of those young people that were attacking the buildings and who were yelling and screaming and so on, that was a multiracial group. There were lots of Latinos in that group. There were lots of whites in that group. I would suspect that that group was at 50% not black. So that's interesting. In fairness, you have to say that, I mean, some of these people were clearly angered by the verdict. Some of them were just kids, thugs, you know, who just had something to do and wanted to spray graffiti on a government building and smash windows because they thought it was a party. So, you know, you have a mix of people. You have people who are genuinely outraged and feel that the system does not work for them, that the rules are different for black people and the justice system. And unfortunately, there's a history of that for black people in this country. There were also kids there that just, you know, I don't think they had a political bone in their bodies. They just wanted to wreak havoc, and they did.
No, I think that the L.A. Times had a few windows smashed today or last night.
Yes, the building had many windows smashed, as a matter of fact.
Do you think that that was directed specifically at the paper, or do you think that that was just like one of many buildings and it wasn't sending a specific message to the paper?
I don't think it was specific to the paper. I think what they did seem to be doing is attacking all official-looking buildings, and the Times is a large building. They may have even thought it was a government building. The bank was also attacked next door here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was anything at the bank. I think that they just wanted to smash windows.
Are you worried about getting home tonight?
I am going to be leaving work early tonight.
Because of the curfew?
Yes, it's because of the curfew. My mother lives in the curfew area, and my daughter is young, 3 years old. My mom keeps her during the afternoon. So I will need to leave work early to get to her house and get secured before dark. I don't feel as if, you know, it's tremendous danger, but I am concerned, yes.
Do you think the curfew is a good idea?
Yes, probably so. The emotions are running very high, and you know, whatever they can do to encourage people to stay in their homes and not stand out and be spectators and turn, you know, and stir things up, I think is useful because people now are going to have to try to look at constructive ways to channel their anger.
Let me ask you: Are you looking at like special routes to get to where you're going to avoid places that might be, you know, conflict spots?
No. In the case of the route that I'm going to have to take tonight, there's really no way for me to avoid possible conflict spots. My mother simply lives, you know, in a route so that there's no other way for me to really avoid that. So I'll do what I can. I'm not terribly worried about it, but I think I would be foolish to ignore the curfew.
Is there anything you'd like to get in that we haven't gotten to before you have to run?
No, just that, you know, it's a very tragic day, not only for Los Angeles, but for the nation, and I hope the nation looks at itself in the mirror and understands that this is not some one crazy thing occurring in L.A., but that this is something that America has to address, and I hope people understand the deeper issues that are underlying all of this chaos.
Well, I guess I should let you go. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Janet Clayton is assistant editor of the Los Angeles Times editorial page. We'll hear from the head of a community security force in Los Angeles after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Yesterday, as soon as the verdicts in the Rodney King case were handed down, community and political leaders gathered at the First African Methodist Episcopal Church in South Central L.A., which has been a focal point for the African American community. Mark Whitlock is the president of the church's men's club. He was on the street most of the night trying to keep peace. He was on alert since the mid-afternoon.
The night began, Terry, for us at about 3 o'clock. Yesterday afternoon when we first heard the rumor that the jury would come in. And then, of course, after we heard the decision by the jury in the evening, of course, escalated into things that we couldn't describe or envision, and not in our lifetime. Beginning at about 5 o'clock, we started to begin to organize the community for a massive rally that we had here at First AME Church, where some 2,000 people met inside the church, and then outside of the church we had well over 1,500 people gathered around the church on the outside microphones to listen to the mayor of the city, Tom Bradley, the presidents and executive directors of the NAACP, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Urban League, as well as the Brotherhood Crusade. Of course, we had different politicians and community leaders come out.
Let me ask you to describe where the church is located and what happened in the neighborhood since the verdict.
Well, our church is located in South Los Angeles, in a multicultural community. We have Hispanics, Koreans, or Asians, and we have African-Americans. After the rally, of course, well, not only after the rally, but during the rally, we had on the outside, some half a mile from us, one Korean store owner, liquor store, was ransacked. People went in and stole food and liquor. We had a service station about 300 feet from there. One of their gas tanks, I assume, was ignited, and that fire caused the fire across the street, which burned an apartment building that was about 200 apartments, and then that fire then spread down the street to several other stores. So it was complete chaos, calamity for, again, the rebellion against the decision that took place yesterday.
Were you, I know the church was trying to organize patrol groups to help cool things off during the night. Did you participate in that?
Yes, I have been assigned by Pastor Murray to head our security force here, and we did have some 100 men in the streets to intervene or to act as emissaries of peace, where we, of course, would stand between the police and the community. The police, of course, doing their job, lined up in a formation much like an army, and to quell the emotions by a sign of force. That sign of force was not received very well by the community, where we saw rocks and metal cans and other debris being thrown at the police.
Can you describe for me one of those specific moments where you feel like you successfully intervened?
I can't give you one specific moment. I can tell you that the police were out there for 3 hours, and so were we.
Mm-hmm.
So with a police force of some 30 people, 30 to 40 people lined up in one row, batons out, their buckle that goes over the gun was open. I would tell you that as they were lined facing the crowd, and debris was being thrown at them, we had another line in front of them, and then, of course, between those individuals who would cause harm, not only to the police, but possibly to some other people within the community that would be in their way. So we stood between the two and, again, began to mediate between the two.
Now, there's a dusk to dawn curfew that's gone into effect. Do you think that that's a good idea?
I think government has nothing to government can only come up with those plans that seem feasible. But when you use with, when you're dealing with human emotions, certainly I think you would agree, and most of your listeners would agree, that a curfew doesn't mean a damn thing. I mean, nobody's going to tell, nobody's going to respect the law, or not the law, we're not going to respect those who have disrespected us for so long. So I don't think it's going to help much. It might give the police officers the right to, again, treat members of our community in a way that they feel is appropriate, and probably, in this case, excessive force.
What about the National Guard? That's a possibility, too, of the
our
National
concern
Guard.
There is the National, our concern is, our real concern is the National Guard. I think if you look at anything from the Watts Rebellion in 1965, it was the National Guard, rookie Army people who come into our community prepared to kill, nervous about the fear of their own safety, and through their fear, could possibly cause the loss of life.
What are your plans for tonight? Do you know yet? Will you be patrolling
again? Same plans that we had last night. We have organized again. We have a group of men who will go into the parameters that we have set here at First AME Church and deal with the community and deal with our neighbors and say to our neighbors that this is our community. We don't need the police to police us. We can certainly police ourselves. We can certainly maintain peace without being disruptive for our families, the businesses in our families, and certainly the members of our communities.
You know what I think mystifies a lot of people and angers a lot of people, too, is why the anger ends up getting taken out on the community that the people are from.
Because it's easier to do it within your own community. It's easier to understand. The people understand your frustration. There is no fear of the unknown. People would like to talk about what they've done successfully. Done within the community as a result of what happened yesterday. So when they go into a store and steal, their friends see them, and then they can go back home, and then they can brag about it. Or they go and they have a fight within their community, they can go back and brag about it. It's unfortunate, but it is true. We certainly don't want to see that happen in our community. In many cases, it's easier to beat up on your own somebody you know up on the unknown.
You have a new police commissioner who will be coming in soon, Willie Williams, who has been the police commissioner in Philadelphia. What's the general feeling about him in Los Angeles and in your community?
Well, the decision is out. The new police chief designate, Willie Williams from Philly, seems to be able to handle himself rather well in front of groups of people. He seems to be a great spokesperson. His track record certainly speaks of good qualifications, and we look forward to what he has to offer to the city of Los Angeles. But the jury is out. We don't know what he will be like once he's under the fire, or once he's in the seat. I think we'll be able to best talk to that in a year. It's just great to see a police chief who looks like an African-American. We just hope that he thinks like an African. And if you look at Clarence Thomas, who sits on the Supreme Court, those who look like us, talk like us, don't necessarily believe in the same things that we believe in and may not have our best interest in mind.
You're obviously very angry right now. And
I'm not angry at all.
Oh, I thought you were very angry about the verdict.
I'm very upset, but I'm not angry.
What's the difference?
Well, I think anger is uncontrolled. I think anger is not directed. I think we have a plan here at First AME Church to deal with the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I was angry yesterday. Go ahead.
Okay. No, I was asking you how you felt you were
personally.
Focusing. Yeah, focusing your feelings.
Yesterday, after the verdict came in, I was extremely angry. I was disappointed. I was frustrated. But now it's clear that we must not only get involved with the political process, but we must mobilize people in the community to get deeply involved with the political process. From there, we must begin to garner economic support. I mean, if we don't own, then we have no real power in this country. So we speak of building black businesses. We speak of African-American youth going to college so they will be qualified to go into business, to employ those so we can have our own. Because we're not, I mean, the verdict that came down yesterday clearly speaks to the injustice that African-Americans have suffered for such a long time, and it doesn't appear that it's going to change. So we cannot depend on government. We cannot depend on the law to be an advocate for African-Americans, to look for justice. We must now look to ourselves.
Do you think that there are a lot of church members who are afraid right now about what's going to happen tonight in their neighborhoods?
I think there are a lot of people in the city of Los Angeles that are afraid. I think the entire Los Angeles County, the entire Southern California area, probably those around the country are concerned about what took place, because I think not only were African Americans disappointed, but I believe that many white people were equally disappointed, equally outraged, because you had to be blind not to see how this man was treated by the LAPD. If your eyes saw the same thing that my eyes saw, then you would have to know that these men used excessive force, that not one man decided to take Rodney King by the arm and simply restrain him. No, they beat him. They beat him for a long time, and then they finally tried to restrain him. But maybe people didn't see what I saw. I know what I saw, and my eyes will not deceive me, and neither will my mind let me not believe what I saw.
Will there be a service tonight at the church?
There will not be a service. We're having meetings, and we'll be convening as we did last night. We'll be convening last night as we did last night, and we will be sending men out into the community.
When do you plan on getting some sleep? I know you've been up since the verdict.
Yeah. I'm sure God will take care of me in that, and I'll be all right.
Listen, thank you very much for your time, and I wish you the best.
Thanks, Terry.
Mark Whitlock spoke to us from the First AME Church in South Central L.A. He's the president of the church's men's club and the head of its security patrol. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, political advertisements. We'll talk with Neil Oxman. He created a very successful ad that just helped Lynn Yackel win the Democratic primary race for U.S. Senate. The ad showed incumbent Senator Arlen Specter grilling Anita Hill, while Yackel asks, "Did this make you as angry as it made me?" Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Playboys, a new movie about life in an Irish town that lies just south of the border with Northern Ireland. It stars Aidan Quinn, Albert Finney, and Robin Wright. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Last night's arson and looting in parts of Los Angeles continues today. The violence broke out in the wake of the acquittal of four L.A. police officers. The mayor of Los Angeles has declared a citywide nighttime curfew. Meanwhile, in Washington, the Justice Department is considering whether motorist Rodney King's civil rights were violated when he was beaten by police officers, and whether to bring federal charges against those officers. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles, and the FBI are conducting what Attorney General William Barr called an active criminal investigation. Barr met this morning with President Bush and afterwards said yesterday's verdict in the King case was not the end of the process.
What we are looking at is whether there was intentional infliction of excessive force, which may constitute a violation of the civil rights laws.
Barr said since October 1988, the Justice Department has charged 123 law enforcement officers with brutality, convicting some 75%. Barr said potential federal charges would not be limited to the four officers who were tried in Los Angeles. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Reacting today to the acquittal yesterday of four Los Angeles police officers, New York City Mayor David Dinkins said it was a sad day for the country and worried that the not guilty verdict would make it much harder to convince blacks that the nation's system of justice can work for them. NPR's Maria Hinojosa reports.
Mayor Dinkins was only one of many of this city's top-ranking officials who expressed concern and indignation over the King verdict. New York City Police Commissioner Lee Brown said he was shocked and called the conduct of the police officers in the videotape an aberration. Dinkins and the commissioner said they did not expect any outbreaks of violence here in New York, but some minor confrontations have already been reported. A group of high school students in Queens, both black and white, held a peaceful walkout from class this morning, and a police officer was shot in the leg this afternoon, although the circumstances of that shooting are not known. The president of the Hispanic Policemen's Association, Walter Alicea, said he worried the King tape would now be used as a training tape for what he called the minority of officers who systematically practice police brutality. Meanwhile, Reverend Al Sharpton has called for a demonstration to protest the verdict for Saturday afternoon. In New York, this is Maria Hinojosa reporting.
City officials in Los Angeles say that an NBA basketball playoff game between the LA Clippers and the Utah Jazz has been canceled because of racial unrest and fires in the area. Officials say the game has been rescheduled for Saturday. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 26 points to close at 3,359. This is NPR News. Testifying on Capitol Hill, Secretary of State James Baker said today that Congress must approve an increase in the U.S. quota for the International Monetary Fund to support a $24 billion international aid package for Russia. Earlier this week, the IMF voted to admit Russia and 11 other former Soviet republics to the group. The aid package for Russia includes a $6 billion fund to stabilize the ruble, which the U.S. portion would be $1.5 billion. Baker appeared before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Congress has once again passed a bill overturning the Bush administration's so-called gag rule, a regulation that staff members in federally funded family planning clinics may not advise clients about abortion. And once again, the White House is expected to veto it. NPR's Maeve Magoran reports.
This is the second effort by House Democrats to overturn the gag rule. Last fall, they were unable to override President Bush's veto of a similar measure. This time, they come about 10 votes short of the two-thirds majority needed for an override. But David Andrews, acting president of Planned Parenthood, which runs many federally funded family planning clinics, says with the restrictive abortion law currently before the Supreme Court, he believes there's national support for an overturn of the gag rule.
This is a time for accountability. And politicians have simply got to stop playing games with the lives and health of American women.
But privately, supporters of the bill in Congress said it's virtually impossible they'll be able to muster enough votes for an override if the president vetoes the bill. I'm Maeve McGoran in Washington.
In New Delhi, more bodies were found today in the wreckage of three downtown buildings. A series of explosions this week destroyed the buildings and killed at least 31 people. Officials say that drums of chemicals carried on a pickup truck caused the explosions. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Pennsylvania held its primary earlier this week. Bill Clinton's win was expected, so was George Bush's. The big surprise was Lynn Yackel's victory in the Democratic primary race for the U.S. Senate. She defeated Lieutenant Governor Mark Single and now faces the incumbent Arlen Specter. Yackel had never run for office before. She said that one of the reasons she went into politics was her outrage at the Senate Judiciary Committee's conduct at the Clarence Thomas hearings, as epitomized by Specter's hostile questioning of Anita Hill. A TV commercial that showed her anger was crucial in boosting her recognition and winning support. The commercial was created by my guest, Neil Oxman, a political consultant who specializes in campaign advertisements. His clients have included Al Gore, Alan Cranston, Les Aspin, and Bob Edgar. We invited him to talk about the Yackel ad and some of the controversy surrounding political advertising. Here's the ad. It opens with Specter questioning Anita Hill.
October 11th.
Did you conclude that Judge Thomas was guilty of sexual harassment?
Did this make you as angry as it made me? I'm Lynn Yackel, and it's time we do something about the mess in Washington. I want to put Pennsylvanians back to work, make health care affordable, and keep the government out of personal family decisions. And I want to beat Arlen Specter in November, because where does it say that our senators have to be career politicians like Arlen Specter?
Lynn Yackel for U.S. Senate.
Tell us how you came up with this ad.
Well, it was obvious that I needed to do something to separate Lynn Yackel away from the rest of the Democratic primary field. We had polled in January, and the lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania in our poll was somewhere in the mid-20s, and the district attorney of Allegheny County, which is Pittsburgh, was in the mid-teens, and Lynn Yackel was at 2. And I thought if I ran sort of a traditional campaign and kind of ran against our Democratic primary opponents, I'm not sure it would have gotten us any place because, A, we didn't have enough money, and, B, I don't think it would have done enough to separate her from the rest of the field because there was also another woman in the race. And I took a chance and decided to run against Arlen Specter from the very beginning as a way to perhaps separate her out, and this is the way that we thought about doing it.
Now, she has said that one of the primary reasons she got into the campaign was because she was so outraged at the Clarence Thomas hearings and at Specter's behavior there. Was it you who came up with the idea of using a soundbite from the hearings in the ad?
Yeah, what I wanted to do was I wanted to, just for a second or two, make voters remember what it was last fall that got them angry, A, about the judiciary, B, about the Senate, C, about politicians in Washington generally, and D, specifically about Arlen Specter. And I also had to do that in just a few seconds, and I thought the way to do it was to recreate the scene and put a soundbite from the judiciary hearings at the beginning of an ad.
Now, did you decide where to place the ads once they were made?
Specifically in what programs, you mean?
Yeah, like what time spots, what stations?
Yes, that's what my company does.
Yeah. So what was your strategy with placing those ads?
Well, our strategy was obviously we were just trying to get 40% of the vote. I mean, there are sort of two ways to buy television. There are lots of ways to buy television. One way is to buy what's called reach, which means you perhaps buy a few shows that have a great deal of audience appeal, whether it's 60 Minutes or Roseanne. The shows are very, very expensive. And, you know, if you don't have a lot of money, as Lynn Yackel really didn't, one of the great misnomers in the campaign was that Lynn Yackel bought the election. She actually only spent $505,000 on television, and her chief opponent, who was leading her, spent more money. Mark Single spent closer to $600,000 on television. So what we decided to do, instead of doing what was called reach, we did a buy that was called frequency. We took a certain audience. For us, the audience was a lot of women 35-plus as well as men 35-plus, and decided to run the ad a great many times aimed at those people, all within a budget of things that we could afford, whether it was Donahue in the morning or Oprah in the afternoon or Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune in Access and a great deal of the early news. We sort of targeted out a select audience and said, we're going to reach you a lot of times and hope that we can drive home this message.
You know, the day after the election, I was listening to interviews with all kinds of experts saying whether Lynn Yackel should play up women's issues or play down women's issues. And it was almost amusing hearing all these people, you know, advising her from afar on both sides of that. I wonder, as someone who did her campaign ads, if you think the word feminism is a no-no in the campaign?
No, I don't. I mean, I've heard people say it in a pejorative tone, and I think if they try to do that this fall, we are going to make that a mistake on our opponent's part, whether it's the press saying it in some sarcastic way, because, you know, a number of reporters have said it to me, and or our opponents, who, if they try to label Lynn a feminist, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with that word. I think that word is perfectly acceptable. And I think if somebody tries to use it in an unacceptable way, they will find out that women and men in Pennsylvania will be very upset. One of the another untold story about Lynn Yackel is that she won a plurality of the male vote on Tuesday.
When you say use the word feminism in an unacceptable way, what would an example of that be?
Well, you know, somebody trying to say, and Arlen Specter has already done this, that Lynn Yackel is a single-issue candidate who ran on one issue, and the sort of code is there that she's a feminist. I mean, other unnamed Republicans in newspapers have said that. I don't think they're going to get away with it.
Political consultant Neil Oxman is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Neil Oxman is my guest, and he does political advertising, and he did the advertisements for the Lynn Yackel campaign. I think it'll be no news to you that a lot of Americans profess to just really hate political advertisements because it cheapens politics to the level of selling toothpaste. How do you defend political ads?
I don't necessarily defend them, but as long as there's a First Amendment and as long as we don't have a British system where the British have this system that has some flaws and some merits, where each of the parties is given 10 minutes a week for a party broadcast. And in a sense, they are political advertising. It's just 10 minutes long. Until the networks change, I'm not going to defend them. I'm just going to use them because I believe in my clients and I want to see them get elected. Until we have a system where everybody has a chance to talk to voters, the way you talk to voters is through television, and the way we should do that is the network should be offering, both locally for local candidates and nationally, offering much more free time to candidates to air their views. But you know why it's not going to happen, Terry?
What do you think?
The reason it's not going to happen is because the $500 or $600 or $700 million a year that political campaigns and candidates spend both nationally and in spot advertising around America, the television stations will never give it up.
You've done some negative ads for your clients. How do you decide whether you should be doing a negative ad or an ad just kind of selling the strengths of your client?
A lot of it is just experience. I mean, we've done almost 200 campaigns. We've made about 5,000 commercials. It changes all the time. It changes. We're doing campaigns this year in over 20 states. And what's acceptable in the northeastern part of the United States is sometimes not acceptable in the Midwest or the South. A lot of it is just experience. The climate that's going on at a certain point, the dialogue that's happening in the campaign, the way the press is treating the campaign. Sometimes you do it in polling, but and sometimes it's just a gut feel. I mean, it's hard to say that there's a cookie cutter answer to why you use negative ads.
Did you ever have a negative ad backfire?
In the sense that it never cost us an election or a client ever dropped precipitously in the polls. We've had, interestingly, when you put negative spots on the air, you know who complains the most? Your own supporters. I mean, my clients always tell me when they're out campaigning and we run positive ads, how much people come up to them and say, hey, great, I saw you on television. But as soon as we put negative ads on the air, it's our own supporters who say to the candidates, why are you doing that? You don't need to say it. And my answer is Mike Dukakis didn't respond to for a month, over a month, to the Willie Horton and Boston Harbor ads and dropped a 17-point lead into losing an election that was absolutely winnable. So it's always hard to make the client buck up to the fact that some people will be angry, but in certain situations you have to do it. A, you either have to attack, or B, you have to respond when you are attacked.
Do you always respond when a client of yours is attacked in a negative ad?
Mark Singel attacked Lynn Yackel at 12:27 a week ago Wednesday in an ad on local Philadelphia television. And at 6 o'clock that last night, we had finished making an ad that was a response, and it was in Federal Express. I mean, so literally, not only sometimes do you have to respond, but you do it in a matter of hours.
How often do you turn down candidates who want to hire you to do ads for them?
Every year, somebody does. I mean, Republicans ask us. We don't do Republicans. And you know, every year there's somebody that, you know, that either you don't like or you don't like their politics or you're too busy, you know, or you're doing something else. Mostly, the reason we don't do people who ask us is because we don't agree with them politically or philosophically.
Now, I believe you represented Wilson Good during his first successful campaign for mayor in Philadelphia, but I believe you turned him down for his reelection bid. How come?
Well, Wilson, who I was very proud of working for when he beat Frank Rizzo in 1983, which at least in Philadelphia was a very seminal event for a lot of things, and really made, I think, for a year the city feel great about itself, had trouble with dropping a bomb in something that I think viewers nationally know as the move event. I thought that Wilson should stand down, and I think that his second term ended up being just a disaster. And Ed Rendell, who had been the district attorney of Philadelphia, was a friend of mine, and I did his campaign to beat Wilson in 87. It's the only time I've ever worked against anybody. I feel very proud of the fact that I did, because Rendell, even though he lost and lost badly, was endorsed by both major editorial boards of the two major newspapers in Philadelphia, and I think acquitted himself well. And then I was lucky enough to work for him in 1991 when he was elected mayor in his own right.
What are the best and worst ads that you've seen during the presidential primary?
I don't want to say necessarily the worst. I think the best ad in the presidential primary was clearly the ad that Pat Buchanan did about taxes in New Hampshire. I have lectured at Oxford. It's patting myself on the back. But in 1989, I was a fellow at Oxford. And this past winter, the professor I lectured with over there asked me to come back just for a day to show all the ads that were being shown in New Hampshire. And I did that the week before the New Hampshire primary. I showed a group of British and American students at Oxford about 35 ads that had aired. And the one that clearly got the best response was the Pat Buchanan ad, where George Bush began by saying, you know, read my lips, no new taxes. And Pat Buchanan rebutted that. I think that's the best ad that worked. Of course, Buchanan's candidacy hasn't gone anyplace since. But that ad was very inexpensive to produce. It looked horrible, but it had the best message, and it got right to people's brains in New Hampshire.
What's the best ad that you think you've come up with, and the most ineffective ad that you think you've done?
there have been hundreds of ineffective ads. I think the best ad I ever wrote was a 60-second bio ad I did for Ed Rendell in reintroducing him to the voters of Philadelphia in February of 1991. Ed Rendell had lost a governor's race to Bob Casey in a Democratic primary in 1986, had lost a mayoral primary in 1987. A lot of people told him he was dead and he couldn't run again. And I did a 60-second bio ad that took all the negatives about Ed Rendell and essentially turned them to positives. And Ed, who was really not ahead in the polls at that point by very much, that ad gave him about a 20-point poll lead, and we never looked back. And I think that was sort of the best producing and the best writing that my company did.
An example of a negative that you turned into a positive?
Well, the fact that everybody said, you know, Rendell lost the mayor's race in 1987. He's a loser. What we said in the ad was he was the only one to stand up to the mess in City Hall. The newspapers agreed and endorsed him for mayor. And what we were talking about was how he stood up to Wilson Good in 1987. And that way that a very quiet voice read in a very dramatic way with pictures, I think really worked.
Were you ever persuaded to vote for somebody or to vote against somebody because of an ad that you saw on TV?
Yes, yes.
What was the ad?
The ad was an ad done in 1978 for Dick Thornburgh, who was the Republican nominee for governor of Pennsylvania. He was running against a man named Pete Flaherty, who was the mayor of Pittsburgh, who was running as the Democratic nominee. And Dick Thornburgh's ad, which was done by a couple of Republicans named Doug Bailey and John Deardorff, who were two of the best Republicans who do this in the United States. At the end of the ad, it said this. They were talking about Flaherty's record as mayor of Pittsburgh. At the end of the ad, an announcer we used to call Knees said this. So the question is this. Can the man who took Pittsburgh to its knees bring Pennsylvania to its feet? The one man who can is Dick Thornburgh. And we always called that announcer Knees afterwards, whom I since met. But that ad made me decide I'm not voting for Pete Flaherty, and I'm a fairly staunch Democrat. I did not vote for Pete Flaherty for governor of Pennsylvania in 1978.
Well, why did that ad convince you?
Well, I mean, it was really the substance of the ad that went before it in terms of how bad a mayor Flaherty really was. I mean, I was on the fence because I thought Flaherty was running a bad campaign. And when I saw the ad, I decided, that's it. That's crystallized it for me. I can't vote for him. I'm going to do something very strangely for me. I'm going to vote Republican. And a lot of Democrats did that year, and Thornburgh got elected.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Media consultant Neil Oxman. His company, The Campaign Group, is based in Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. Here's some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. NPR's Elaine Corey reports from Los Angeles on the violent reaction to the not guilty verdict in the trial of the four policemen accused of beating Rodney King. Brian Naylor has a report on the reaction of the president and the Justice Department. Patricia Naiman talks with residents of the predominantly white suburban Simi Valley where the trial was held. The residents are divided in their reactions to the verdict. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. With the success of My Left Foot and Hear My Song, Ireland suddenly looks like a movie trend. Even Tom Cruise's summer blockbuster Far and Away is set there, with a huge budget and a cast of thousands. But the latest movie from Ireland is a little more modest. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of The Playboys.
It is modest, yes, and small-scaled and even rather predictable. But its very littleness makes its virtues seem larger. And though the Playboys won't sear your soul or maybe even live very long in your memory, it's a sweet diversion, well-written, deftly directed, and wonderfully performed. The Playboys is set in a tiny village just south of the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland. The year is 1957, and no one in the village realizes that an era is ending. The director, Gillies McKinnon, underplays everything, but he wants us to notice when the first television arrives in town, because that black and white window on the world spells doom for the two warring forces that have formed life here for centuries. One of those forces, the church, has nothing to offer except Sunday sermons and pinched morality. And the other force, which might be called temptation, comes in a variety of forms. Illicit sex, hard drinking, and every so often the arrival of a traveling theater troupe like the one called the Playboys. As the movie opens, the town has just been scandalized by the birth of a baby. The father is unknown, and the unwed, headstrong young mother is Tara, played by Robin Wright, a woman so beautiful and tough-minded and self-possessed that her very existence makes the little town sweat and itch. When the Playboys set up their theater tent, their leading man, Tom, played by Aidan Quinn, notices Tara right away and entices her with stories of his days in America, some of which, Tara soon discovers, aren't quite true.
You're a liar.
Huh?
You've never been to America in your entire life. Last winter you were in jail in Dublin for bigamy. What?
Who told you that?
Who do you think? Tom, if you think I'm going to gamble away my future and my baby's future on a chancer like you, you're mad! I picked the wrong man once before. I'm not making the same mistake again.
Wait, Tara. Wait till I give you the truth of it. It was me brother who committed the bigamy. I just took the blame for him.
Why?
Well, so he could get back to the wife and the kids. The ones he left behind in America.
Tom, you're full of cock and bull.
Tara, all you have to do is ask anyone in Dublin.
I'm not in Dublin.
Tom and Tara make up two legs of a triangle, and the third is the local police sergeant, Brendan Hegarty, played by Albert Finney. He's hell-bent on marrying Tara, baby and all. Hegarty is like a living battleground on which those two forces, Catholic repression and worldly temptation, wage their endless conflict, and Finney shows you the war wounds with every step he takes. He gives a grand, frightening performance. But then, this is a movie full of good performances. Aidan Quinn, for instance, has enough charm to overcome his drifting Irish accent, and Robin Wright is something of a revelation. She's grown more confident and inventive since her bland performances in The Princess Bride and State of Grace. And in The Playboys, she has some of the grave sensuality of the young Jessica Lange. The movie lilts along at a surprisingly energetic clip, so much so that the little beauties in the screenplay by Shane Connaughton and Carrie Crabb might almost go unnoticed, like, for instance, the way almost everything the Playboys do during their raucous stage performances is somehow reflected in the movie's plot, even down to the handkerchief that serves in the Playboys' Othello and also in Sergeant Hegarty's own private torment. In the end, the Playboys veers near tragedy without ever touching it, and so it winds up being almost too light to be satisfying. Still, you can be grateful for a movie without a trace of overkill or bombast. The Playboys isn't a meal, it's a refreshment.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. If you have any comments about Fresh Air, call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, and Phyllis Myers, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Ronald and Nancy Reagan talked a lot about traditional family values, but they didn't practice them, according to their daughter, Patty Davis. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Davis about growing up in what she describes as a dysfunctional family. Also, we talk about how political polls reflect and manipulate public opinion. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
You're listening to 91 FM
and it's now a minute before 8.